This is A View from the Ditch, a podcast about politics in Ireland and elsewhere. I'm William Dalton. On this edition of the programme, my co-host James Larkin and I discuss Ivana Bacsik's election as leader of the Labour Party. Bacsik was confirmed as the new leader last Thursday, the 24th of March, having been the only candidate nominated to succeed Ellen Kelly. If you want to contact us, our email is aviewfromtheditch@gmail.com. Or you can find us on Twitter at AVFTD Radio. So obviously, it's a time of global upheaval, war in Ukraine, spectre of nuclear war.
Yep.
And so naturally,
COVID pandemic is over. Inflation is off the charts.
Yeah, the cost of living crisis, of course, climate crisis, which barely gets mentioned these days. Ireland's neutrality, which is some would say under attack. But so naturally enough, we're here.
The big story: the party on 3% is a party of 3% is leaders have change.
Yeah, exactly. Naturally enough, we're here to discuss Labour, who I'd say they're averaging around 4% in the polls. So, and the most recent Sunday Business Post poll there had them on 5, which is a bit of an outlier. But anyway,
could be a Bacsik bump.
Bacsik bump, yeah, perhaps. Ivana Bacsik, people will be aware, has been elected the 14th leader of the Labour Party since its foundation.
How many in the last 10 years?
In 1912. 5 in the last 10 years, yeah, as a lot of people have pointed out, which is quite a lot. I think we should probably start by going back to the ousting of that man, Ellen Kelly.
Well, he resigned.
Yeah, so he, and this was the kind of focus of the interview. Many people might have heard that Bacsik did with Sarah McInerney and RT Drive Time. The circumstances of that resignation on the 2nd of March. So he said at the time he was advised by parliamentary colleagues that they had lost confidence in his leadership the previous day. Mm. And there were reports of this meeting of the parliamentary party at Mary Sherlock's house.
And I think one of the big talking points was that is Duncan Smith, one of his close allies, was part of the team wielding the knife. So to start mixing metaphors, then the writing was on the wall for Eld Allen.
Yeah, it seems there was almost unanimous agreement in the parliamentary party that he should go. And the justifications at the time were opinion polling was the main one. There was these references to staffing issues, which was something to do with there were issues with the process by which some backroom job in the party was filled by Ellen Kelly. But that doesn't seem to be the main reason. Doesn't sound like a reason to get rid of a party leader. And then the other thing was just his general style and personality.
It's not you, it's me conversation. It was very much, it's not me, it's you.
Yeah, and there are all these kind of euphemistic ways that people refer, like journalists will refer to Ellen Kelly, like his abrasive style or his brusque manner, which sound like a lot of ways of euphemisms for he's a bollocks.
An arsehole.
Yeah. And
what he says, what he means, and where's his heart in his sleeve, as we saw from his resignation speech where he was close to tears.
Yes.
So the emotional tough guy attitude hides a soft center.
really, I think it's sort of a Humphrey Bogart type of situation. Interesting.
But the one thing I noticed afterwards was that, am I right in saying some of the counselors were like, what the fuck? Like,
yeah.
we like this guy.
So the examiner at the time...
consulted.
Yeah, the examiner at the time reported that the membership was baffled. That was the word they used. And then you had various counselors expressing surprise. Dermot Lacey, people will be aware of for his angry tweets. Ciarán Hearn, who was Shannon... candidate last year, he said, "I'm genuinely shocked." Other counselors,
he seems like a real batshit man.
And well, but it is strange. Like, it's very unusual for a party to dump its leader in the middle of an election cycle when he's just been elected at the end of the previous election cycle. You know what I mean? And
even when they're doing that dreadfully.
Well, you see, and I said,
"It's Corbyn."
Yes, that's true. Rather different circumstances.
Different circumstances in that they had a less favorable electoral system than, like, it's just much easier to get rid of the Irish Labour Party than it is the British one.
Is that the case? Well, it's easier when you only have 6 TDs.
Well, maybe that's it.
So you only need to get 6 people
to have a unanimous decision.
But the public justification, as I said to you at the time, it didn't really sort of ring true to me. The idea that it was based on polling, because their polling numbers were bad, and they still are, but they weren't particularly worse than their previous general election results in 2020. In 2020.
Yeah, but that was like their worst result ever.
It was their worst result ever, yeah.
Yeah, so that's not saying much.
No, but it's less than 2 years into the cycle. So if you were Alan Kelly, you'd be saying, well, you know, polling numbers this far out from a general election don't mean that much. You know, judge me on election results, not polling.
Yeah, and his big thing was like, I need to get down and press the flesh. You know, I'm best one-to-one. COVID's been holding me back. And you're like, I'm about to be unleashed on this, on the demos.
Yeah, and maybe they were worried that when that happened, the polling numbers would really hit the skids. And I'm not saying this like, you know, particularly in defense of Alan Kelly. I'm just saying the public narrative didn't really stack up.
But what's your theory then?
I don't have a particular theory.
Ah, come on. You must have something.
I just am dissatisfied with what we're being told publicly about the reasons for getting rid of him.
All right, Mike, do you want to hear my theory?
I do, yeah.
My theory is that we know what the fact is, that most of the TDs didn't want him in the first place, to the extent that he couldn't even get a nomination in the last leadership election.
That's right, yeah. And back in 2016, he couldn't. No one would second him when he.
So they were close to unanimous from the get go in not liking him. So it only took to flip two or maybe even one person to get to this point. And the last 2 years couldn't have really gone much worse in that they went nowhere fast. And well, that was the main issue. So that person flipped, and maybe, you know, and it seems like that was Duncan Smith. Maybe one other. I don't know.
That's a good point, you know, that perhaps he never, based on everything we know and the all these kind of euphemisms about his personality, he never had the support, much like Jeremy Corbyn, he never actually had the support of his parliamentary colleagues, even though the members elected him.
And they just needed to wait long enough in order to not really piss off the members.
Yeah, even though it seems like they have pissed off some of the members.
Yeah, but that's how much they disliked Kelly, probably, that they're like, oh, fuck this. Like, you know, yeah, we're going to piss off most of them, but I can't handle this anymore.
Now, I'm sure...
I can't deal with this fucker anymore.
I'm sure if Anna Vacek would deny that in the strongest terms, she was careful. You
know, like,
she paid tribute to him in that interview with Sarah.
Oh, give me a break. In the interview, she said the whole thing stonewalling Sarah McInerney, changing the subject on the two most important issues, which was... how did this happen? How did Alan Kelly get ousted? How were you involved? She didn't answer any questions directly. And secondly, do you regret any of your decisions when Labour were in government with Fianna Gael?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I want to come back to
I understand why she'd stonewall the ousting of Kelly to a certain extent, even though she could have said something like, she would have said something along the lines of, look, of course, we're always evaluating things in the Labour Party. We want to be the best party we can. You know, conversations happen all the time. But... you know, no, there was no, you know, grand plan. You know, I think you've been watching too much you know, drama Netflix there, Sarah. Now, you know, there's nothing to see here. You know, something like that, maybe.
You're watching too much. Stonewalling. You've been watching too much of The Thick of It.
Yeah,
perhaps. No, she didn't give a satisfactory answer to that question of Kelly's ousting, and it is a fair question, you know, because it goes to the question of democracy. You know, the membership elected this guy, whether you like him or not.
Yeah,
and what has he done to invalidate that mandate they gave? 55% of the members voted for him in whatever April 2020, and that mandate has been overturned by the parliamentary elite, if you like.
Yeah,
and I think Sarah McInerney was quite right to press that question of, you know, let's have a little bit of transparency as to what actually occurred there.
Yeah.
And
then after that, on top of that, they don't even get to vote on the next leadership election.
That's right, because there was only one candidate. They were presented with a.
And I wonder, did that go through the TD's mind? It's like, oh Jesus, we don't want a shit show, you know, going out and doing hustling and being given out to for getting rid of Alan Kelly.
Yeah, well, it seems like they had already agreed before they told Alan Kelly that he was a gunner. They had already agreed on their candidate, that Bacik was their woman. And
which brings us on to the question of why Bacik, but maybe you want to stay on Alan Kelly.
Oh yeah, well, I want to stay on Alan Kelly for a second. Like one of the things I thought was funny, like Mary Sherlock was quoted as saying that the senator Mary Sherlock was quoted as saying the party needs, quote, generational change. And just for the record, Ivana Bacik is 7 years older than Alan Kelly.
But William, age is just a number.
That's
like,
true.
Alan Kelly has been has been an old man since he was in his 20s. Meanwhile, Ivana Bacik speaks to young people.
That's a fair point. I'm probably quite wrong to bring chronological age into this, because it is, after all, just a number. Farewell, Alan Kelly. Power is a drug, he said infamously, and it suits me.
I really can't believe he said that.
Yeah, that was... That's one that I would think haunts him to some extent.
But I'd like to hear I'd love to hear the recording of that one, because it just doesn't even feel real. It's so silly. Did he refer to himself as an AK-47, or was that other people?
Oh, I think that was just a general a moniker applied by other people. And Harry McGee in his report made some kind of reference to, oh, the AK-47 could go off unexpectedly, or like, you know, if you speaking of tortured metaphors.
Yeah. But at least he tells it like it is. Like, power is a drug, and most politicians do like it.
Tells it like it is, though, James.
He's willing to say it. At least he's honest about it. Like, most other people are like, oh, no, you know, I want to serve the people. Most of them want to serve the people. You know, power is a drug, and they like it.
Well, you could have read it as him saying, oh, you know, power is a drug. In other words, you need to be careful that you don't get hooked.
That is a very generous reading. He didn't give any indication that he wanted to lay off the power.
And then there was the other thing.
It was hooking into my veins, was the sense I got.
Yeah, that I think that was the general impression. And also, after that, the thing that sticks in my mind is the images of him at the Count Center in 2016, where his party were getting massacred at the polls. And when his personal re-election was confirmed, he reacted like he had literally... to use another cliche here, scored the winning penalty in the World Cup final. And
because he got a hit of the good stuff.
He got a hit, yeah. Power was a drug, and he got...
And he was going through withdrawal.
Yeah.
Now I'm really torturing the metaphor.
Anyway, that's the end of Alan Kelly as Labour leader, it would seem. No, not of his political career. Of course, he's still there. And
you fancy that he might join Fine Gael.
Did I say that? Well, no, yep.
Off record.
I was referring to the fact that Michael O'Leary in 1982 went very quickly from being Labour leader to being a Fine Gael TD. So there is a precedent for a Labour leader very soon joining one of the right-wing parties. Because people have said, oh, you know, Kelly, he's really a Fianna Fáiler. He's not really Labour, whatever that means. And So I'm not saying I'm not predicting that he's going to join Fine Gael, but I'm just saying if that does happen, there is that precedent. Anyway, the other thing you said, the other question in the Bacic interview that she sort of, let's say, didn't deal with terribly well was the question of the legacy of the coalition, which was
Sarah McInerney put it to her that, you know, she was describing herself as, you know, a change candidate and you know, she gave change to people of Ireland. And she was like, what the hell are you talking about? You know, you as in, she had quite a senior position in the Shannon and
she was Labour leader in the Shannon.
Yeah, and pushed through legislation, you know, on single parent allowance cuts and water charges, to name two of many. And I was shocked that she just couldn't bring herself to say, yeah, look, you know, I'm sorry about that. It was a big mistake and I want to lead, plow a different, because I'm full of crap metaphors this evening. I want to go a different route now. But she'd said she was kind of half justifying it, you know, there were tough decisions, blah, 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 and stonewalling the rest of the time.
Yeah, no, I would say more than half justifying it, because she, as you said, like, she can't, you know, she was the leader in the Shannon. She was helping push through these policies that were so incredibly unpopular that they led to Labour going from 37 seats to 7 in 2016 and down to 6 last election. And she said in that interview, you know, this old narrative about, oh, the previous government had bankrupted the country and the coalition, quote, saved us from the brink of financial ruin, which, as I say, is an old narrative that Labour have tried, you know, under Joan Burton and then under Howland, and it hasn't worked for them at the last two elections, which are their two worst ever. And so she's hoping that this time it's going to be different. The same narrative was sort of being trotted out in the Fergus Finlay piece that Sarah McInerney alluded to. Fergus Finlay, of course, was a Labour senior advisor for a long time, 20 years or so. And he said in that piece, quote, we made disastrous decisions in relation to housing, water charges, and other things. Or to be more accurate, we managed those decisions appallingly badly. We've almost entirely lost our self-belief. So he seems to be saying it's not the fact that they introduced, you know, that they cut the lone parent allowance or tried to introduce water charges. It's that they didn't kind of manage the narrative well enough. And then it's this kind of...
it's not completely clear what he's saying there. He might have said we needed to tweak the policies or...
Yeah, but there is this, you do hear from Labour people, you know, this idea that the electorate was ungrateful.
Didn't understand.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, do you want to hear my theory on, this one?
Naturally, I do, yes.
Well, my theory on this one is either, when you do something that's, like, if you do something that has very drastic consequences, you know, you might not want to admit to yourself that it was the wrong decision, because, you know, then you'll have to reckon with those consequences. So, you know, to do something so drastic that, like, they can't admit they're wrong. Like, you know, it's a pretty basic human problem. And there is some justification to what they did. You know, they did kind of mitigate some of, you know, you can see the argument and you hear it time and time again, but it's just incredible that I find it incredible that they just can't see the wood for the trees. And even if they do truly believe that, you know, they can't just bring themselves to say sorry and even just to get back in the game, like, because it seems to be one of the big things holding them back.
Yeah, but the problem is if Bacic starts to say things like that, well, she's vulnerable on that because people can attack her and say, well, you pushed through austerity in those years as leader in the Shannon. So her record, so she has to sort of stand over her own record to some extent, and her own record is pushing through austerity.
But surely there's some people who say, look, surely there's some people who say, you know, that was a mistake.
Yeah, but you're talking like about...
Wasn't there some senior, I know they're not elected, but wasn't there some senior technocrat in like Germany who said the austerity was a terrible idea? I was heavily involved in it.
I think even the IMF have said that, you know, and so every, you know, so it's a losing argument.
Well, I'll give you an example. I'd say, you know, the Green Party, for example, introduced a higher excise duty on petrol than diesel, because at the time they thought that it was a more carbon intensive fuel. And we've since found out different information to say, and I'm sure that if you ask them now, they say, oh, look, we didn't realize, you know, we were just doing what we were told by the technocrats. Why couldn't she say something like that?
Well, she could, but I think to disavow the coalition would be much wider kind of condemnation of your past and your own political past than that. You know, than that kind. That's kind of what you've mentioned there, is that one sort of technical policy issue, whereas this is you're saying a whole orientation of the party was wrong. And her, you know, the Shannon, she's only been a TD for less than a year. So the Shannon at this point is the majority of her political career. So she would be saying that was all wrong, you know, which maybe she, you know, maybe that would be the right thing to do, but it's unlikely that she's going
to
do that.
Well, then that brings me to another point. Then why do they pick her as opposed to someone who is less tarnished with the government streak? Like you'll remember this better than me, but are there people in the Dáil? I'm thinking Jed Nash or Duncan Smith, who weren't as closely involved with that government.
Yes, there are. So the only person who's still in the Oireachtas who was a senior cabinet minister at the time is Howlam. So he's obviously not going to be the next leader.
Well, Éan O'Riordan was, you know, a junior minister, wasn't he?
He was a junior minister, so he's associated with that government as well. But I think he has been more, he has been keener to distance himself from the policies of those years. And kind of say that they were wrong, and not defend them in the way that Patrick is doing, I think.
Well, comrades, it's my pleasure to welcome you to the first meeting of the Administrative Council and to congratulate the people who have been elected by annual conference and the people who have been nominated by the party leader as parliamentary representative.
Last week, Michael D. Higgins, ex-senator and unsuccessful parliamentary candidate in four different elections, presided over his first meeting of the Labour Party's ruling body, the Administrative Council. Throughout the coalition period, Higgins moved steadily to the left, and today the former Senate nominee of Liam Cosgrave is intractably opposed to coalition pacts, believing that Labour has suffered immeasurably by its involvement in government with Fine Gael.
I think it has had a terrible time in a number of ways, as it had to cut back its socialist programme. It has lost membership. It lost, I think, a certain amount of credibility to some extent, this was reflected in its ability to capture a significant proportion of the young vote, which one would have hoped for. I think that one is better being quite factually honest about that. And what it has to do now, I think, this time, is that when it starts this time, it has to first of all make sure that there is an unequivocal commitment to policy that are themselves unambiguous and practical. And I think that the practical policies for the Labour Party at this time are socialist policies, and that it simply cannot be seen to waver from that path. And if it does so, to my mind, it will have lost ground again. And I really believe that the Labour Party is poised in a very exciting time, that it can develop, but that it will not develop unless we are straightforward in what we're aiming for. Just taking
up. So in her actual speech that she made on being elected, There were a couple of, you know, substantive policy points in there. She proposed a guarantee of publicly funded preschool for every child, and a windfall tax on energy companies. You know, both of which sound like good ideas to me in principle. But I think I get the feeling that ultimately this is a change in leadership style, rather than substance for Labour, because of those remarks she made on, you know, defending the coalition quite strongly.
And she does, you know, she's a good orator, she's diplomatic, she speaks to younger people much more than Alan Kelly does. So, you know, that could be a... Well, I would say, it could be better than Alan Kelly, which isn't saying much. But where I think it might be particularly interesting is if Sinn Féin go into government and how they position themselves then and how well they do in the polls then. Like, that's when it'll really count, I think.
Yes, and she did allude to you know, that kind of question of positioning. She said, you know, we're offering something different to the binary choice of the right-wing parties, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, or Sinn Féin. And, you know, Alan Kelly was quite willing to attack Sinn Féin. So it'll be interesting to see if that'll also be her approach.
Yeah. But she kind of feels very social democrat-y to me.
You mean social, as in the Sock Dems, the party, or social yes. democracy in general? Yeah, well, but the Sock Dems, of course, were, you know, their existence came out of Labour's struggles, you know.
Yeah.
And so they're largely disillusioned Labour people.
Yeah.
So
it feels like she's moving more towards their style of the party.
Yes, yes, except she's still batting.
Yeah, the big difference in style is that she's still justifying their time in government, which social democrats, would you believe, don't really do.
No, and they have no interest in, they have no need to defend austerity and no inclination either. So there is still, you know, and people have been saying for years, oh, Labour and Sock Dems should just get together, but there are fundamental differences there on those kinds of questions. And also, I'd say a fair bit of personal bitterness, which isn't going to go away under a Batchik leadership, I think we agree.
No.
And there is still, yeah, I was going to kind of say, you know, both in what she said and what Fergus Finlay said and what we've heard from a lot of Labour figures over the years is like that the electorate was ungrateful. You know, Labour put country first, put country before party. But I think unfortunately for Labour, the country doesn't seem to agree with that.
No.
And, you know, it's like the Brecht poem, would it not be simpler for the government to dissolve the people and elect another? That's what Labour seems to want. I do want to say, in terms of to say something positive about Labour, last year at some point they changed their emblem. Did you notice this?
Of course not.
Well, they got rid of the rose and went back to the starry plough, which for right. most of their history was their emblem. And I want to say I think it looks very nice. Well done to them on that.
Jeez, that's pretty limp praise.
No, well, I am being sincere. We shall see. Batchik, and there was, of course, that rather upsetting poll for supporters of Batchik. Albeit a premature one, that. But it was, you know, before she'd actually taken up her post, but that showed that more people were less inclined to vote for Labour with Batchik as leader than were more inclined.
That's true, but I was thinking about that since, and I wonder were the type of people who said they were less inclined, the type of people who were never going to vote for them anyway.
Yeah.
Like, what if someone rang you up now and said, hi, William, just doing a poll here for, you know, insert polling company name here, and we're just wondering, with the election of Ivana Batchik as the new Labour leader, would you consider yourself more likely to vote for the Labour Party or less likely?
Well, yeah, I see what you mean. That the what does it mean to ask someone who's
no, I'm asking you, William. Whoa, excuse me. We don't need you to give us an opinion on our polling decisions. Just
well,
give
I would
down
try.
Answer.
What I would try to give an honest answer to that and say
I don't need nuance here. I'm a pollster, William. Time is money.
No, but the question is more likely.
You're more likely or less likely.
But that I could still feel.
Oh Jesus!
That
okay,
I'd never,
I'm hanging up now.
Are you asking me personally?
Yeah.
I don't know. I honestly, I don't know how to answer that. But
your pollster's nightmare.
But it's not great that more people said they were less likely than more likely. You know, it's not a great indication. Because Batchik is a reasonably well-known figure. It's not like no one's ever heard of her. And there's been a bit of reaction on social media to that Sarah McInerney interview that we referenced, which the consensus is not that it was a flying start to the new era.
That's true, but the social media brigade is generally anti-Labour, so certainly the one in our echo chamber. So I wouldn't put too much stock in that.
Fair enough. Our echo chamber, is it?
Yeah.
Well, fair enough. That's me. That's me told. I know. Well, yeah. If anything, I'd say Labour is more popular on social media than it is in the electorate at large, where it's, as we referenced earlier, it's floating around.
Yeah, that's not saying much, though, is it?
4%. It's not saying much, no, at this point. But as Bacik did say in that interview, Labour has been around, you know, for 110 years. They've had their difficulties before. Never quite this bad, but...
although she didn't sound that confident they were going to be around for another 110 years. Didn't even sound that confident they're going to be around for the next 10 years, she answered that question. It was kind of, we'll see if they'll be around, as opposed to, there's no stopping us. We'll be here long before me and you are gone, Sarah.
Well, I mean, who so among us...
have answered that question.
I mean, who among us is confident that any given institution is going to be around in 10 years?
Yeah, she's in... You got to lie, you know, you got to fake it till you make it, will you?
I'm not sure. Anyway.
We'll leave it at that. I think we've got Labour sussed for now.
Yeah, we shall see how this develops.
You know, bi-weekly basis.
That's the plan. Anyway, congratulations to Ivana Bacik. That's it for this edition of A View from the Ditch. Our theme music was performed by Natalina Kasija and Irla O'Donnell. And again, our email address is aviewfromtheditch@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.